Please be advised, the following podcast may contain opinions, advice, or other suggestive content regarding mental health, and as we are not experts, should be treated as discretionary. Please consult with a medical professional if you are struggling with mental health issues. Alternatively, if you are experiencing a mental health emergency, please dial 988 or go to your nearest emergency room.
You're back for another episode of Luminosity, and we're so glad you're with us. We took 2 weeks off. If you've subscribed and followed the show, we apologize for being a little bit tardy on our recordings. Kevin and I have taken a little bit of time to get situated in our new lifestyles. We're also working on a live event right now, and a lot of times people just get busy. So as you've stayed patient, we hope so. The episode on this one's called Attachment and Codependency, which we will be getting into today. It's something that a lot of times that folks who are either just discovering their mental health or even starting to work on a lot of types of relationships that they have in their life that pertain to their mental health, something we knew we wanted to cover this season with you guys. So thanks for joining us wherever you're listening. And Kevin has put together such an amazing opportunity for us to talk about this stuff, as he always does. So I just know that, he probably has more thought power on this too. So again, attachment and codependency on this episode of Luminosity.
Yeah, guys. So we have a lot to cover in this episode, and thanks for tuning in. So the first thing that came to mind when I was putting this outline together was, what are attachment and codependency? How are they similar? How are they different? And there's sort of a multifaceted approach that one can take when answering that question. The truth is they are pretty similar in a lot of ways. I, for one, happen to believe that codependency is the result of unhealthy attachment, and I would think that a lot of, medical professionals would agree with that. But it seems that attachment is the root cause of codependency, and codependency is sort of like a byproduct of attachment. So we wanted to cover them both in here, but we'll get started with attachment, as that is, again, the root cause. So what is attachment, right? Emotional attachment refers to the feelings of closeness and affection that help sustain meaningful relationships over time. Attachment plays an important role in human connection. So that's pretty self-explanatory, right? We kind of all have to have these sacred bonds with our loved ones, and we form these emotional connections probably, through like... we were talking about like oxytocin and stuff like that in one of our
Happiness hormones.
Yeah, there seems to be a biological thing going on here in attachment, to the point that it can actually become addictive, and we'll get to that later in codependency. But again, that's how attachment kind of leads to codependency. Is sort of, it's like relationship addiction, and that dopamine rush, that serotonin rush, whatever it is, becomes somewhat addictive, similarly to a drug. But yes, nonetheless, emotional attachment is, these feelings of, closeness and affection that help sustain these meaningful relationships over time. So there is something called attachment theory. Justin, why don't you take this one? But, I thought it would be important that we explore, attachment theory to get a better sense of how attachment plays into, our emotional bonds with caregivers and impacts our future relationships, stuff like that.
100%. So the theory, so it's the idea that early emotional bonds with our caregivers impacts our future relationships, AKA exploring these three distinct attachment styles that affect the way that we deal with relationship conflicts, our feelings towards sex, and our expectations of romantic intimacy. Okay, a couple of triggers, because like at the end of the day, if anybody's listening right now and you've yet to experience some of these things, or you're still in discovery of your sexuality, or there's so many, right? I can go down the nuanced journey of this stuff, but it's interesting. Like one theory set to the, way that the caregiver has impacted us that now affects all of our relationships, and essentially caregivers being who, Kevin? Like parents, right? People who cared for us as children.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's important to realize too, that, attachment theory, in my opinion, still applies beyond just romantic relationships. This definition that we sort of put in the outline is within the context of a, you know, romantic intimacy. But I do think it can extend beyond that, even in friendships or relationship with family members. It has more to do with the baseline attachment and the underlying attachment as opposed to the type of relationship that this attachment theory is playing out in. Also, I did want to include this. It's kind of like a visual of a triangle. Listener, I'm going to go through this with you, but it has more to do with something called consummate love. But I've actually seen this before in some of my mental health treatment, and it is a visual that is used a lot of the time to sort of visualize what real consummate love and healthy love should look like. So when you think of consummate love, just think of healthy love. So if we are going through this as, you know, like if we are referring to a relationship that is romantic in nature, then let's just go with that for a second and say that, you know, we have a romantic relationship and this attachment theory is part of it, right? As it is with any relationship. So we have imagine a triangle, listener, and kind of like a pyramid, right? A flat two-dimensional pyramid. In the middle, you have consummate love. And consummate love is the healthiest kind of love that you can have. And that lies inside the pyramid. It includes intimacy, passion, and commitment. And then at the top of the pyramid, the tippy top, the point, we have what's called liking. That is intimacy. So a love that includes intimacy, but only intimacy, would be just considered liking. That's not love, right? And then at the bottom left of the triangle, the bottom left point, you have infatuation, and that is otherwise known as passion, right? So if you have passion for someone and your relationship includes passion, that's infatuation, but again, it's not love. And then at the right, the bottom right, the tippy top of the pyramid, well, the tippy right, would be empty love, and that is solely commitment, right? So each one of the points of the pyramid are one facet of what consummate love should look like, but they can't live on their own as a consummate love, right? That's why we have the combination of all three in the middle known as consummate love. Now, here's where it gets interesting. On the sides of the triangle, for instance, the left side of the triangle in between the top point of liking and the bottom left of infatuation, you have what's called romantic love. And that is the combination of passion and intimacy. That's the combination of the top point and the bottom left point, right? So somewhere along that middle part of the side of the pyramid is romantic love, passion, and intimacy. Then if you go on the other side, it's the same thing. You're combining liking at the top of the pyramid and empty love at the bottom right, and you have what's called companionate love, which is intimacy and commitment, right? So the bottom of the triangle, which includes a love known as fatuous love, which is passion and commitment, is the combination of infatuation, passion at the bottom left, and empty love, commitment at the bottom right. So through this visual, we see how there are actually love is kind of like a spectrum, and you can have different kinds of love. Like, for instance, if I'm in a relationship and it includes companionate love, well, then you could argue that that includes intimacy and commitment, but it's lacking passion, and therefore it's not consummate love, right? Or, you know, infatuation. Infatuation has passion, but it doesn't have intimacy nor commitment. So it's not until we get to consummate love that it is sort of the healthiest, perfect kind of love. So I just want to go through that visual with our listener. And maybe, Justin, you can go through this next bullet point here, which talks about how attachments develop.
I mean, yeah, even to the first theory, it seems like they develop over time as a child and caregiver interact. But that's most things, right? We've discussed this many times on this podcast where, like, they're are always going to be like childhood triggers and traumas and things you went through as a child that, like, over time you're going to have to rediscover or unpack in your adult life just simply because they were happening as you were a child. And it says here that It is innate or hardwired, quote unquote. See, like everything feels like it's hardwired or fixed in your brain as a child.
Yeah. That kind of goes in part with ideas of, like, in my opinion, cognitive psychology, which says
100%.
I believe it's cognitive psychology, but it basically just says like that everything is a learned behavior from the time that you're a kid.
That's right. Even like this example here, it mentions that like if a child falls off her bike and a caregiver comes over and comforts her, the child learns to expect that, you know, and the expectation as a child, a lot of times it's like, it's weird. This might be sound a little weird to say, but even with pets, it's like they obey their masters and they're, I mean, you have Wrigley, so you get this, but like when you feed Wrigley and pet Wrigley and say good boy for not barking and peeing on the pad instead of all over the floor, it's like, not similarly, but in a similar sense, when we're children, that is the same type of, you know, attachment you get to your, you know, caregiver as a dog would to the owner. I hate to say it, but like at the end of the day, it's like human nature. And a lot of times dogs have that instinct the same way that humans do, to attach themselves to the person that is caring for them, right?
That's true. And I think you're bringing up a point. Dropped my mic again. I did that the last episode. Damn it. I always do that.
Hey, best part here is that like no one would have ever noticed that Kevin dropped his mic until he said he dropped his mic. So it just made for a better episode.
We'll keep that in. Anyway, so it kind of goes like with what I believe to be the nature of all like sort of biological or at least like mammalian animals, which is you made the example of like a dog and how a dog, you know, the caregiver is me, you know, Wrigley's owner.
Right.
Then it's the same thing as like a parent and a child, right? Or if you let's say you have a bear and a cub out in the wild, like the cub is going to learn from the bear, the mother bear or the papa bear. So I don't think this is unique to just humans. I think this is a mechanism of psychology in action for all living beings and an sort of like an operation of the brain, really. Mm. So I do want to talk about three main features of attachment. And it's something called, the first one is called proximity maintenance. Mm. And that is the desire to be near the people we are attached to, which kind of goes, you can see how this can sort of lead to an unhealthy addiction in codependency if you've constantly feel this need to be attached or near, physically near someone. And I'm sure it's possible to want to be near them and still have a healthy relationship, but it's when it becomes unhealthy that you're sort of, I would say, changing your life around being near that person or sacrificing yourself to be near that person.
Sure.
So number two is safe haven. Returning to the attachment figure for comfort and safety in the face of a fear or threat. That makes a lot of sense to me. And then secure base is number three. The attachment figure acts as a base of security from which the child can explore the surrounding environment. So this is
interesting.
These are like, I think I've mentioned it to my listeners, but I am currently enrolled in I'm like a psychology major in school, but this is like a lot of the stuff that it talks about. You know, it's kind of like a child needs to explore their surroundings and their learn to interact with the world around them in order to gain the confidence and the independence needed to function. There's actually a really interesting story. This is kind of a tangent, but it shows just how important a secure base and attachment is. I want to take the time to mention to our listeners the story of a girl named Jeannie. I believe her name was Jeannie. And I think she's still alive, but she was from, I believe, Alhambra, California, which is just outside of Los Angeles. And she grew up in I think it was the 70s.
Okay.
But from the time that she was born, she was kept in her crib, I believe. And then when she was, you know, just starting to get to the age where she would have started walking, her parents strapped her into a defecation chair that she could, like, with a hole in it and defecate. And they locked her in it. And this was a form of torture. It was later ruled by a judge. But basically, she was strapped in this chair so that she could use the bathroom. They would give her like certain amounts of water to keep her alive. They would, you know, she couldn't move her legs. She couldn't explore the world around her. She was locked in her room with the blinds closed. And this lasted until the time that she was like 10 years old. So she went like 8 years, like strapped to this chair essentially. And she would like sleep in the chair and stuff. Like she couldn't get out of the chair. And later when like the authorities got involved and, you know, like brought her to social services, she wasn't able to walk. She wasn't able to walk on her own. She wasn't able to talk on her own. She had a very poor understanding of language, and her auditory cortex or whatever, like the parts of her brain that control hearing and stuff, were like not very responsive. And this, nothing like, it's not like she had a traumatic brain injury that caused all this. It was simply a psychosocial development based on the circumstances of being locked to a chair and not able to explore her surroundings and being severely isolated with no caregiver and no secure base. So sure.
All good. All good points, by the way, which is like all of them aligning, right? Where she can't go to her surroundings. She can't explore anything. She has no sense of security.
Yeah. And this concept of secure base is actually really important as a child develops in their cognitive abilities and in what we call cognitive psychology to live their life independently. So if that's taken away from them, I mean, Jeannie is in her, I think she's in her like 60s now or something, and she still cannot function on her own. She lives in a home and she like doesn't talk. But this was like a huge story in the LA Times back in the 70s or something. But anyway, it shows just how important attachment and, you know, certain like having a secure base from our caregivers, like how much our caregivers actually play into how we form attachments and develop cognitively as we get older. So 10 facts about attachment for thought. Do you want to go through some of these, Justin?
Yeah, of course. All right. So you said there's 10?
Yeah, they're just like, I found these facts that I think are really important. And, you know, going back to the concept of self-awareness and Luminosity's mission, I think it's just, these are just some nice things for our listeners to hear.
Totally.
To understand attachment.
Number one, attachments to people prevent us from examining ourselves. Clinging to someone in a relationship often masks an underlying sense of lack or unworthiness that can benefit from your loving exploration. That's so interesting.
I think that meant a sense or lack of unworthiness, something as a typo, but whatever. We'll keep going.
Yeah. Well, it's a, right to your point. So, and then a question is stated where it's like, are you willing to take the focus off the other to see what your thoughts and feelings that are driving you? I see this. Maybe we'll do this. I'll go down one. Maybe we can chat about it. You get on the second, you know, we chat about it third. But like this first one's interesting because I'm single. I've been single and I probably will stay single for a very long time. And I'm noticing that like whether or not it's a male or female in a relationship that I'm close to and I meet their significant other, significantly enough, I've done nothing but that since being in New York right now. I've met everyone's significant other. And I'm starting to notice that like they have this clinging attachment style, most of them. And I noticed when I met you and Calby, that's not necessarily, that wasn't a thing. You know, I'm not saying that everybody I'm meeting is clinging onto each other, but it's interesting how like, I can tell that the focus is way too much on the two together, as opposed to like the two being independent that happen to be together. And to be quite honest with you, it's why I don't date.
That's very interesting. Well, I kind of take that as a compliment. Well, thanks. And, you know, Kelby and I don't know. I think we've done pretty well of living our own independent lives and then coming together, as you mentioned. And that's not to say that she hasn't been in relationships in the past where she does exhibit those kind of clingy behaviors or me exhibiting those clingy behaviors. I think if it's the right couple, then it sort of just works that you're focusing on yourself and you lift each other up to the point that you're not really clinging. You're just sort of coming together because it makes your lives better.
That's right.
Thanks for saying that. I appreciate that. And Don't doubt yourself, bro. You're talking about, and I'm probably going to stay single for a long time. You don't know that.
Well, I'm just assuming.
You don't know that.
I'm just in my, I feel like I'm in my analysis phase where I'm very happy. We'll go to this in a moment, but like, I'm very happy with the friendships that I have and the family that I have and like deeper connections I have with people, so much so that I can wait a little bit longer to go find that intimate partner.
I get what you mean.
That's all I mean by that. But in general, like it's, I'm starting anything, to notice, bro, trends and such.
If anything, the fact that you have remained single this long and are spending this much time focusing on yourself, it just think it's going to make it that much better because you'll be coming into a new relationship with
hopefully someone that has the same done work, right? Yes. That's what I'm a little bit apprehensive about.
Yes. And a sense of, you'll have a better sense of self than you would have otherwise had you not taken that.
That's exactly right.
Be with yourself.
Yeah.
So it's not a, you know, it's not a bad thing at all. You could definitely see it as a good thing. Attachments to identities keep us stuck. All right. This is number two. Are you aware of any habitual ways in which you react emotionally? See if you can pinpoint the identity you hold about yourself. Maybe it doesn't serve you anymore, and you can give yourself the freedom to respond with greater wisdom and awareness. This is really interesting because I think the key part here is this sentence right here. See if you can pinpoint the identity you hold about yourself. We tend to get stuck on identities, and I love that this, you know, the title of this fact here is Attachments to Identities Keep Us Stuck, because that's so true. I've been in this place before where I'm so attached to an identity or putting myself in a box, sort of this black and white thinking like, sure, oh, I am this, I am that. But I've learned as I've gotten older, like my identity is so fluid. Like an identity, it doesn't have to be like this blanket statement of like, you know, like right now, you know, Justin, you see, I've got this mustache, right? I'm rocking this.
Right.
Beard, right? So like a couple weeks ago, I didn't have that. I just decided to grow it. I was like, oh, you know what? Like it's getting towards October. I might grow it out. And, you know, today I now have like a full grown, like, I think it's called a Van Dyke, but I think that's what it's called. Yeah. It's like a beard goatee thing, but I have it fully grown out. And so you could say that like my identity today is someone with a beard. And tomorrow, if I shave it, then that identity goes away. And my identity is someone without a beard. Like it doesn't, identity doesn't have to be this huge blanket statement and these drastic, you know, sort of identities that we put ourselves in boxes. It can be something like, you know, I am someone who enjoys taking 6 a.m. morning walks. That's an identity, right? Like that, you could argue that's a part of who I am.
For sure.
So at that point, it's like, does this identity thing really have to be like some, oh, like I suffer from depression. Like that to me doesn't seem any more of an identity than, you know, I like to swim for one of my hobbies.
Yeah.
You know, you want to take number three?
Yeah, of course. So number three is, what often underlies attachment is a fear of not being in control. That's interesting. And then it mentions here a question, can you befriend the unknown and receive things as they happen? What are your thoughts? I have thoughts.
Huh. I do think control is a huge part of unhealthy attachment. So it makes sense to me that they're sort of, you know, the author of this is sort of like making sense of that, saying that underneath attachment, there may be a fear of not having that control. That makes sense to me. And I do think that, like, I don't know. I think it's important to just take things as they come. And I've also kind of learned to let go of my control. And it's definitely served me better than trying to hold on so tightly. It's easier said than done, though, you know, because like there are things that I want to hold on tightly to. So it's not, it's sort of like it's a practice in that way. But what do you think?
So when I first read that, I was like, well, so if the underlying attachment is the fear of not having control or not being in control, rather, I thought it was the opposite. I tend to like detach myself from people because I don't have that control. So it's the opposite. I mean, I have the opposite experience where I'm like, if I don't have control over something, I don't necessarily want to even be near it or even look at it or smell it, you know, not a person, but anything, you know, if I don't have control. And so I often wonder if that's like got anything to do with this, or, you know, if people are relating right now as you're listening, it's like, okay, well, think about this for a sec. Like, if you're not in control and that's the reason you're attached is because you want the other person to be in control, then that's one way. And then on the opposite, it sounds like this is where that lies, you know,
that's
where
interesting.
Like, you're fearful that because you don't have control, then you're attaching yourself to someone, but aren't you then giving up the control?
That's interesting that you've identified that part of yourself. I mean, what do you think? Do you think that this control thing you speak of could have something to do with attachment?
I think I have the avoidant behavior of that, though, right? So I'm avoiding being in a relationship that I don't think I can necessarily control or have, you know, control over. Whereas what this is saying is that people fear not being in control, therefore they attach themselves more, which I think is the opposite of what I feel.
I feel like you just learned something about yourself.
Yeah, I did.
Therapy 101.
Therapy 101.
All right, I'll take number four. The root of many relationship problems is that people are attached to what others should say or do. Huh, interesting. Recognize when someone is attached to how you should be, rather than resisting and creating conflict. Stay grounded in yourself. Feel compassion for the other's fear and confusion. Yeah, I like that. Like empathy, compassion. Yeah, and I think it's unhealthy for others to have an attachment or expectation of how we should be, you know?
Mm.
That's not healthy attachment either.
At all.
You have any thoughts on that?
I mean, I don't think anybody should subject themselves to what anybody else says or does, right? That's like not healthy ever.
Yeah, because then like, you're sacrificing yourself.
Yeah, it's like a secondary golden rule. You don't want to treat people as if you're not being treated the same right way. It's the same in relationships. You don't want to give up all of your self and all this potential to like be loved or to love based on what other people think that you should be saying or doing. That's like so odd to me. And I think that people fall in traps in relationships. Again, speaking as someone who's never been in a full-time relationship, they fall in these traps where it's like, I have to like cater to the person because I really think I'm in love with them, or I need to listen to them, or they think I should be doing this. And so they all start altering themselves based on that other person. It's kind of why I'm avoiding it. So like, I might be the black sheep in anybody who's listening to this podcast episode. I avoid relationships because I don't want to be told what to do. And I don't want to alter my state or being of who Justin is because I'm still working on him. And if anybody comes in to try and step on that, I just don't want to deal with it. Whereas other people in relationships, listen, if you're in a very passive way of your life and you're happy to like mix and alter and blend yourself with this other person, that's amazing. And that's typically how great relationships get started. I just don't have that.
Hopefully for the right person, you won't have that feeling of having to sacrifice yourself and being told what to do by the other person, you know?
For sure. And like that usually kind of depends on where the other person stands and why they're even there in the relationship with you to begin with.
Yes, for sure.
So
do you want to take the next one?
All right, let's do it. Attachment to possessions or money is all about fear. Oh, that's interesting. Have as many possessions as you want, but don't stake your happiness on them. Okay, for sure. Do your possessions define you? It's a great question. Deeply contemplate losing all of them and then realize that you don't really own anything. Oh, I've done that. You've done that too. I mean, we've lost. I think you and I have like had a lot and we've lost a lot. And we've had a lot and we've lost a lot. And you and I have stayed in this like very neutral state. I'm generalizing here because Kevin and I have been moving around a lot, but I'm almost, yeah.
What that like, that's so interesting. The last part, deeply contemplate losing them all and realize that you don't really own anything.
I mean, I've done that. Have you not done that? I've walked that through my head before.
No,
it's like,
it's very, what's the word? Like,
not morbid,
ephemeral. It's very ephemeral. Is that the right word? It's very,
Joey, look it up. No, I'm kidding. Where's the Joey when we need him?
No, not ephemeral.
Joe Rogan's guy's name is Joey.
I'm thinking of ethereal, I think. Yeah, like it's just so philosophical. You know,
it's okay. So, God, I thought you were going to say something like it's like so not good to say out loud.
No. I just meant like it's so like heady, like it's so ethereal. Like,
no, but that's valid, right? I think that's the reason we do this podcast. Like, we should all deeply contemplate about losing everything that you have right now, including the laptop you and I are recording on. You know, all of the emails that you and I have logged into, my cell phone that I'm holding right here, this microphone. I mean, anything. It's like, imagine losing all of it. People today, right. Around the world, don't have what most of us have anyway. So it's like, I don't know why people attach themselves to possessions or money to begin with. It's odd. And it almost makes you realize like, okay, well, you should be doing a little bit more work on yourself instead of fearing what you're going to lose of a thing or money that you can always get back.
I love that. Yeah. I want to try out this exercise for myself. I do love it. It's awesome. All right. I'll take number six. Attachment to wanting what you don't have leads to interminable unhappiness. Can you shift your orientation to appreciate what is already here? That is very valid. You know, I think a lot of the time we spend so much time wishing or praying or whatever, hoping for something that will come that we don't have. And we get so lost in this idea that we don't have it that we forget about what we do have, you know? So, you know, I think that's, I practice that in my daily life. Like sometimes when I find myself like wanting something very much and it's like just not coming my way, then I have to like shift my perspective and be like, wait a minute, but like, do I really need that? Because look what I already have, all this great stuff and that great stuff. So
for sure.
Yeah,
I agree.
You want to take number seven?
That's my favorite number. Being attached to your needs makes you a victim of your circumstances. Okay, that's weird. We have to break that down. Do you really need what you think you need? Maybe you're stronger and more whole than you think. God, these are deep, Kevin. Where the hell did you pull these from?
I know.
Okay, do you really need what you need? Well, let's go back. Hold on. Being attached to your needs makes you a victim of circumstances.
All right, stop like, there. What does that mean to you?
I mean, I just circle back to my, like, what do I need versus what do I want?
It almost seems like it's implying
needs were a good thing.
Yeah, but it almost seems that it's implying that what your needs like may change. So it's like being attached to your needs in any given moment will make you a victim of your circumstances in that moment.
Okay, so say you need that. Okay, let's go through an example. Say you need, oh God, I can't even think of one. Water?
You really need that job. You need a job
to make money. Amazing.
Yeah.
Okay. But then the circumstances that you work a full-time job for a corporate business that maybe later you don't like. And so that's where it becomes a thing where you fall victim to it. I don't know. Like, that's where I'm getting confused. Like, it sounds like a trip because what you need is what you need. And you're going to be doing most people who are resilient or ambitious are going to figure out ways to get what they need no matter what, right? That's how the human body or the human experience works. But then to fall victim to an experience based off of that, I'm falling a little bit out of the loop here because that doesn't. Oh, wait. Okay. Then maybe the question that brought itself up makes the most sense now. So it's like, do you really need what you think you need? That they should have led with that. Like, do you need what you really think you need? So if you need a job, yes. But then you're not necessarily falling victim to a circumstance that you had to go create for yourself because you needed the money from the job. But whereas if it's like, I need a new iPhone, you don't. My dad used to say that. He's like, you don't need a new iPhone. And lately, like, everybody else is getting the new one. And like, no one talks about that anymore if you think about it. This is good for mental health. Back in the day, everybody wanted the new iPhone to be like hip, cool, like in with the know, trendy. And lately no one has, I mean, I've met people with like 17 versions of iPhones these days. Put five people in a room, they all have different iPhones. It's kind of cool.
Look at your analytical skills. That was a very, very impressive.
You're analysis. Very lucky to be podcasting with this guy named Justin. No, I'm kidding. But really, I mean, that's what it is. Do we really need what we think we need? And that's kind of where we need to kind of spend the most time here. If anybody's going to reflect on this after the podcast, like, do you need that candle? Like, even if you're just, you know, do you really need all those groceries or should you just kind of limit it? And you know what I mean? Like there's, I think we're living in a world of excess and essentially falling victim to the circumstance of doing too much, maybe.
Living in a world of excess.
It's too much.
Yes. That's like the golden point right there. Okay, number eight, not being attached brings relaxation and ease. You no longer worry about losing what you have. This doesn't mean that you aren't excited about having something or sad about its loss, but your underlying peace is not disturbed. I like that. I mean, yeah, because emotions about, you know, being sad about losing something, kind of like grief, right? Or
right.
Excited about having something, those are valid emotions. And, you know, you should be able to experience those in the moment. But I think if you're not attached to them, you can have those emotions and sort of have like a cautious optimism that like, hey, I have this now, but I'm also aware that I may not have it later. And so, you know, I'm okay with that. I have peace with that. And if it doesn't work out, then so be it.
For sure.
That's how I interpret it.
And then number nine here.
Yeah.
Attachment to beliefs and ideas is like living in a small space with many walls. Oh, that's intense. Everywhere you turn, you bump into one. Can you let yourself be vulnerable and open to abandoning your treasured beliefs? Shoo.
Wow.
Yeah.
Again, another kind of ethereal, like super heady philosophical one.
That's right.
Attachment to beliefs and ideas is like living in a small space with many walls. Quite the visual. Can you let yourself be vulnerable and open by abandoning your treasured beliefs? Yeah, it's like everywhere you turn, you bump into a problem or a... I like the idea that like, okay, you're living in a small space with many walls. It's starting to click with me now. Okay, so imagine like how claustrophobic and small that room would be, right? But it's like so you're going to bump into these walls, right? But if you are vulnerable and open by abandoning your treasured beliefs and your attachments, then imagine how much larger that room is going to get. And it's almost like it's expanding your inner circle and expanding. It's like giving you the room to breathe and giving you all this room to explore in a larger room, right? Because if you are not attached to any one thing or outcome or treasured belief, then it gives you the freedom to sort of like go find something else that you might not have been able to discover had you been so attached, like that kind of thing.
Right.
It's a metaphor, but it actually makes a lot of sense to me.
For sure.
I think there's one more. I'll take it. When all attachments fall away, what remains is reality. When we see things without the veil of our attachments, we realize life, delicious, pure, luminous, and true. Delicious. Delicious life. Luminous. I like it. Luminous. Luminosity.
Yeah.
Yes. When we see things without the veil of our attachments. You know, it's funny how these, as we went through these 10 sort of facts about attachment, it seems to be that these were geared towards more like attachment towards objects or materialism, which I think actually works within the context of attachment, because we covered both attachment to people and emotional bonds type of attachment, you know, in relationships. But then also you could argue that that's a very similar attachment to a thing or a material thing, right? I think it's important that we cover both of these. And when all attachments fall away, what remains is reality, right? We see things without the veil of our attachments, and we see life for its true nature without our own preconceived notions or biases or attachments getting in the way of what is reality or truth. So with that, I think we should go on to codependency.
Period. Because,
you know, now we have a good understanding of attachment, but how does that necessarily lead into codependency? So, Justin, why don't you take the definition?
Excessive emotional or psychological reliance on a partner, typically one who requires support on account or of an illness or an addiction. Interesting.
Yeah. And in psychology, codependency is a theory that attempts to explain imbalanced relationships where one person enables another person's self-destructive behavior, such as addiction, poor mental health, immaturity, irresponsibility, or underachievement. Now, I think this is the most important part of this episode because, you know, it's fine to have an understanding of attachment, but really the reason why Justin and I, listener, wanted to tell you guys about attachment before we got into codependency is because codependency seems to be where attachment becomes relevant to mental health. Because we all have, I would argue most of us have experienced a codependent relationship in one form or another. And it is it is sort of like this relationship addiction, right? It says here, codependency is also known as relationship addiction. And I think it's just important that we have an understanding of what it is and what it looks like and the base for codependency so that we know how to avoid it or steer clear of it if that's what's necessary. But codependency is just, it seems to be like a very topical thing in mental health and it leads to poor mental health. That's been my discovery. You know, Justin, I included a link here. Do you have your computer near you?
Of course.
Pull this up. Go to this link right here that I include in the outline. It's a great resource that I found from our friends at Mental Health America. And listener, Justin and I have been talking to Mental Health America for quite some time. And we even had a Zoom meeting with America, one of our friends over there. Her name is America.
Her name is America, right?
Yeah.
And Mental Health America. She works for Mental Health America.
Which is like the best thing ever. But totally. Let's go to this website and see this resource here on codependency. So I've got it here. I just want to go through this. And, you know, give a little shout out to our friends at Mental Health America for creating such a phenomenal resource that's so easily accessible. Listener, if you want to check it out, go to mhanational.org/co-dependency. And you will find here that there's a whole webpage about codependency, how it's treated when codependency hits home, a questionnaire even to identify signs of codependency, characteristics of codependent people, how they behave. I mean, this is just the jackpot for codependency within the context of mental health. So do you want to just go through this real quick, Justin, and we could read it for our listeners in the event that our listeners do not have access to a computer, if they're driving right now, and then we can wrap up there.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, cool. You take the first one.
So just overall, codependency is a learned behavior that has been passed down from one generation to another, which is not something we necessarily think about. It's an emotional or behavioral condition that affects an individual's ability to have a healthy, mutually satisfying relationship. It is also known as a relationship addiction, because people with codependency often form or maintain relationships that are one-sided, emotionally destructive, and/or abusive, which makes total sense, by the way. The disorder was first identified about 10 years ago as a result of years of studying interpersonal relationships in families and in families of alcoholics. Codependent behavior is learned by watching and imitating other family members who display this type of behavior. That's insane.
There you go. That's the, you know, the watching and learning from your caregivers that we were talking about. So who does codependency affect? Codependency often affects a spouse, a parent, sibling, friend, or coworker of a person afflicted with alcohol or drug dependence.
Wow.
Originally, codependent was a term used to describe partners in chemical dependency, persons living with or in a relationship with an addicted person. Similar patterns have been seen in people in relationships with chronically or mentally ill individuals. So again, that's kind of how it, you know, plays into mental health, even if you're not struggling with mental health. With drug or alcohol abuse, right? So mentally ill people are more prone to exhibiting codependency or codependent behaviors. Okay, so today,
wow.
However, the term has broadened to describe any codependent person from any dysfunctional family. That makes a lot of sense to me, much more broad now. What is a dysfunctional family and how does it lead to codependency? A dysfunctional family is one in which members suffer from fear, anger, pain, or shame that is ignored or denied. Underlying problems may include any of the following. And I've read about this concept in like a dysfunctional family with, you know, like the roles that are taken on in a dysfunctional family, the identified patient, the golden child, the whatever it is, right? An addiction by a family member to drugs, alcohol, relationships, work, food, sex, or gambling. The existence of physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, right? So these are all underlying problems that are included in a dysfunctional family, can be included. The presence of a family member suffering from a chronic mental or physical illness. Dysfunctional families do not acknowledge that problems exist. They don't talk about them or confront them. And as a result, family members learn to repress emotions and disregard their own needs. They become survivors and develop behaviors that help them deny, ignore, or avoid difficult emotions. They detach themselves. They don't talk. They don't touch. They don't confront. They don't feel. They don't trust. The identity and emotional development of the members of a dysfunctional family are often inhibited. Attention and energy focus on the family member who is ill or addicted. Interesting. The codependent person typically sacrifices his or her needs to take care of a person who is sick. When codependents place other people's health, welfare, and safety before their own, they can lose contact with their own needs, desires, and sense of self. Interesting. You want to take the next section, Justin?
For sure. How do codependent people behave? So it's like, if you're thinking about, like, if you ever watch other people in their relationships, or maybe even your own significant other and yours now, codependents have low self-esteem and look for anything outside of themselves to make them feel better, which might be hard to see on the outside, but like, that's definitely a thing. They find it hard to believe in themselves or even be themselves. Some try to feel better through alcohol, drugs, or nicotine and become addicted. Others may develop compulsive behaviors like workaholism, gambling, or indiscriminate sexual activity. They have good intentions. They try to take care of a person who's experiencing difficulty, but the caretaking becomes compulsive and defeating, which is, well, let me pause there. So the caretaking becomes compulsive and defeating. Essentially defeating the purpose of even taking care of the person who's in need. Do you think that's what that means?
Compulsive and defeating.
Maybe it becomes so overwhelmingly like, can I help you? Can I help you? Can I help you? That like it defeats the purpose experiencing difficulty.
Okay, that makes sense to me. That seems to be like the way we could interpret that. Yeah, like the caretaking becomes that it's compulsive in the sense that there's just, you're always, that person is always trying to help, even if the other person like doesn't need helping, maybe.
Yeah.
And it sort of fuels this codependency, maybe.
Got it. No, that makes sense. And then codependents often take on
a martyr's role.
Martyr's role and become benefactors to an individual in need. A wife may cover for her alcoholic husband. A mother may make excuses for a truant child. Kevin's better at grammar than Justin. Or a father may pull some strings to keep his child from suffering the consequences of delinquent behavior. Interesting. The problem is that these repeated rescue attempts allow the needy individual to continue on a destructive course and to become even more dependent on the unhealthy caretaking of the benefactor, which makes sense. I'm trying to think through as I'm saying these things out loud, like, wait, what is that really? Have we seen this before? And now I'm going to start thinking about it. Maybe even tonight, Kevin, like Kevin and I are going to walk away from this podcast and be like, oh, wait, I actually like noticed that tonight, Justin. Wait,
it really is.
Me too.
I just have to say it's a phenomenal resource, this webpage here. And Mental Health America really did a nice job putting this together, but
100%.
It really does make me think. But do you want to keep going?
For sure. As this resilience increases, the codependent develops.
Oh, as the reliance increases.
As the reliance increases, the codependent develops a sense of reward and satisfaction from being needed. That makes sense. When the caretaking becomes compulsive, the codependent feels choiceless and helpless in this relationship, but is unable to break away from the cycle of behavior that causes it. Codependents view themselves as victims and are attracted to the same weakness in the love and friendship of relationships. Interesting.
That's very interesting. All right, I'm going to keep going here. Characteristics of codependent people are an exaggerated sense of responsibility for the actions of others. A tendency to confuse love and pity with the tendency to love people they can pity and rescue. a tendency to do more than their share all the time, a tendency to become hurt when people don't recognize their efforts, an unhealthy dependence on relationships. The codependent will do anything to hold on to a relationship and to avoid the feeling of abandonment. Wow, that's like BPD stuff right there, you know?
Right.
I wonder if there's a correlation. An extreme need for approval and recognition, a sense of guilt when asserting themselves, a compelling need to control others, lack of trust in self and or others, fear of being abandoned or alone, difficulty identifying feelings, rigidity and difficulty adjusting to change, problems with intimacy or boundaries, chronic anger, lying or dishonesty, poor communications, or difficulty making decisions.
We won't go into the questionnaire, by the way, but I think that, and we'll link this below when this episode gets put out.
Yeah, we won't. I mean, you know, we don't have to go through the
Kevin
the
is like, right, we're going to go through the question. No.
But we have to link this though for our listeners so that they can at least see the questionnaire and like ask these questions of themselves, right?
Yeah.
And see, I will just say here a condensed, the Cliff Notes version of how is codependency treated, because there is a section here on it. Yeah. And it says that it's usually rooted in a person's childhood. Treatment often involves exploration into early childhood issues and the relationship to current destructive behavior patterns.
Right.
So I just interpret that to be psychotherapy. So
for sure. Listen, and as you're going through these like characteristics, I'm not going to lie. If you're listening right now, like, I mean, I can relate to some of those, but I will also say that I have outgrown some of those. So the more, I mean, it's almost like a proven thing. Kevin, you're probably the same way. It feels like a proven thing that some of these characteristics of codependency that have been rooted in like our childhood, the way we were brought up with our caretakers and things like that, like there are ways to come out of that or outgrow it or whatever that makes sense for you as you continue to grow and mature into your adulthood. Because as he's reading those, I'm like, oh my God, I definitely remember doing that. Oh no, that was the time that I gifted 15 people. They didn't give me back and I got super pissed, you know? And I think that that's like, it's normal. It's like actual human nature to experience some of these codependent characteristics. But then it's like, once now, you know, you can hopefully go and set forth some of letting go of these characteristics in a healthy way.
Absolutely. So I think we definitely have to link that in our description here. So assuming we do, then listener, it should be in the episode description right on your Spotify or your Apple Podcasts, wherever you're listening. Go ahead and click that and go ahead and take a look at how codependency is treated, as well as the questionnaire, which we think could be super beneficial for you to even just look over and ask yourself. It doesn't have to be, you know, you don't have to write it down or whatever, but just, you know, take the time to ponder about it. It could lead to some increased self-awareness, and that's what Luminosity is all about, right?
Well, I think that at the end of the day, like most of us don't think about relationships in this way, intimate or not. Like you do kind of have to start with the self and say, hey, where has my attachment styles and, you know, possible characteristics of being codependent, where have they played into my life thus far? And you'll find that like, after we've just mentioned some of these things, it's not that they're positive or negative, right? I think it's like in general, these are just the facts of attachment and codependency, but as it relates to you and how you want to navigate your healthy relationships, you know, and the one you have with yourself. I mean, even as a single man, like I'm starting to think about how I relate myself to friendships based on everything you just listed, you know, and it's always healthy to check back in with those things and figure out which ones you need to like change, alter, completely exile out. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Completely agree. Well, Justin, I think this was a really solid conversation. I learned a lot. I don't know about you, but, you know, I hope our listeners learned a lot. And oh, also listener, before we go ahead and look up the consummate love triangle. If you want to get a better sense of what we were talking about earlier on in the episode, I think it's really important that we look at that as well, because I think it goes hand in hand with codependency. Really consummate love seems to be the best shot at avoiding codependent behaviors. That would be my guess. But overall, we hope you enjoyed this episode, and go ahead and toss us a rating or follow us on social media at Luminosity Health Pod. Follow us on social media at Kevin G. Quinn, at Hey Justin Crawford. Anything else I need to tell our listener?
No, Kevin's getting really good at this signing off thing.
Yeah, this is usually Justin's
job. I have
nothing
else to add besides taking everything we just discussed and hopefully relating it back to what you might need in your life right now, whether you're single, in a relationship, in a marriage, or dealing with, you know, former and past relationships with your
or family. You know, like, yeah. I think that's another big one where there can be some of these behaviors can play out too. Yeah. You got
we look forward
else?
To catching you guys on the next episode. That's for sure. Yes, we sir. Certainly won't be late to that next one. So thank you for hanging with us for the past 2 weeks as we didn't put anything out. But this one was on attachment and codependency. And we're excited to see what you guys think about it. So be sure to catch us on Instagram, wherever you want to find us to chat with us about your thoughts. Most importantly, as you reflect on what we've discussed today, we'd love for you to leave a rating and review. And then we'll certainly catch you next time on this podcast. Yeah, thank you for listening.
Thanks so much, guys. See you next week.
If you enjoyed this episode, Kevin and I would love if you would share it with someone who you believe can find value in the conversation too. Also, if you loved the episode, the show will only grow and reach more people with ratings and reviews. If you'd be so kind to leave one right where you're listening. We sure hope you found this helpful and cannot wait for you to come back to another episode of Luminosity.